This is a test of the emergency podcast system.
It is a true emergency.
Quick, run. We love aliens.
It's not rude.
What can you do?
It's science. Just do it.
Welcome to Mystery Team Inc.
Warren.
You always count. I can never tell if I'm supposed to roll on the three or on the rolling because the space between them is always different. So there's no way to anticipate when I'm supposed to hit the button.
Well, this time I forgot the word for roll.
That explains it.
So that's why there was a little gap.
That explains it. We're in. Welcome to Mystery Team Inc., the podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Damn.
Did we do it?
Yeah, you like blew through that like we're on episode 53 or whatever.
Thanks for coming, everybody. That's our show. I'm Maggie. That's Kayla. So far, so good.
That was great.
So we're going to start the show tonight. We'd like a suggestion from the audience on a place you can be. That you can't leave.
Your in-law's house.
I heard your in-law's house. We're going to start a scene where we're at our in-law's house. Can you imagine if I just made you do improv right now?
I was going to do it.
I know, you were really on board. I was surprised. I thought you were going to shut me down the second I started by asking for a suggestion.
No, I've decided to start yes-anding your improv.
Wow, you finally learned the first rule.
I know.
Oh, what a joy it is. Okay, do you have any time of show business? Because I do.
Oh, no, I don't. You're the business one.
Okay, first of all, I have some TikTok of show business.
Oh, wah, wah. Good one.
So as I mentioned on the last episode, we're trying to like grow our social media presence and like just like exist in the world beyond just screaming into the void. So we've recently like been upping our game on our Instagram and we started a TikTok account. We're not TikTok influencers yet, but if you want to get in on the ground floor, you should go watch our videos because we basically do like fun minute-long recaps of mysteries that we've done, and they're kind of like teasers for the episodes. So I'm having a great time.
I'm having a blast.
And they're really fun. So we would love it if you would go watch them. If you don't follow us on the social platforms, you should go follow us. As always, we also like to get emails. Our email is mysteryteamincorporated@gmail.com. Second top of show business is I have a corrections corner.
Oh, God.
So remember in the, Sleepy Time Tea Cult, how you were like, Michael?
No. What?
Okay.
So, I need a little more context than one name.
in the Urantia book, there was like a quote that I gave where they were like, after Michael came, Jesus was the planetary prince. And you were like, who is Michael?
Right, and, right. I remember that.
Yeah. And also, I was talking, there's like in the Urantia book, they talk about Lucifer's rebellion. And you were like, what is that? And Chris reached out and was like, hey, I think they're probably referring to the Archangel Michael. And also, Lucifer's rebellion is a thing. It's a way of referring to the fall of Lucifer, because as I'm sure you recall, Lucifer was one of God's angels, and then he... Okay, this is... First, let me just say, this is for entertainment purposes only. But...
No, allegedly... Well, I just want to say, I know this because I played Diablo.
Allegedly, Lucifer was one of God's angels, and then he, like, became prideful or whatever, and God, like, cast him out, and that was, like, considered Lucifer's rebellion. Like, he turned a bunch of angels against God or whatever, and so... That is a real thing, real in like heavy air quotes. But we didn't know that because we went to an Episcopal school, which is like the Miller Lite of Christianity. And not only an Episcopal school, but an Episcopal school in LA, which means that like the, we had like chapel, which wasn't even church. And the chaplain wore like a lav, like he had a body mic.
Yep. Oh my God. I forgot that our chaplain was lav.
And performed Metallica at the fucking talent show. So like,
and Episcopalians, our school was 49% Jewish.
Yeah, so Episcopal school in the Valley, like, was not big on scripture. I remember vaguely. I remember the only thing about scripture that I remember from going to school there was the time that the chaplain, the new chaplain, showed up dressed as Moses, and it didn't go over well. And I don't think he ever did it again after that. But it was iconic. It was. Anyway, yeah, so that's my corrections corner.
Great. I loved it.
I'm so excited to hear what your mystery is. Oh, are you ready? Wait. Are you ready for a mystery?
Okay. So, this is the disappearance of Nicholas Barclay.
Oh my God, it's all happening.
Everything's coming up.
Mysteries.
Deedee, deedee, deedee.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. Okay, tell me everything.
Okay, ready?
Tell me everything. Okay. Let's spill the tea.
I'm going to tell you like a lot.
I'm excited.
So first I have to give a shout out to the documentary Imposter, where I got about 99.9% of this information.
Incredible.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, but I think I stopped watching it because it was like freaking me out. Because it's like there's something like spooky about it to me.
It's ooky. It's psychologically ooky.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have not seen The Imposter, it's not The Imposter. It's Imposter. It's on Amazon Prime. It's incredible. And I think it might be one of my favorite documentaries.
Ooh.
I know. So, Nicholas Barclay was born on December 31st, 1989, and he grew up in San Antonio, Texas, with his mother, Beverly Dollarhide, which I love.
That's
because
a name.
Frances Dollarhide, well, from Hannibal.
Yeah.
Frances Dollarhide, do you see?
Yeah. Do you see?
Do you see? So, Nicholas had two older siblings from Beverly's previous marriage, a sister, Carrie, and a brother, Jason. Nicholas was a problem child. His mom said he thought he was an adult. We called him 13 going on 30, which is a very fun and flirty film.
Starring Jennifer Garner.
And Mark Ruffalo.
2007.
Very difficult to discipline.
No.
Was it?
Was it? I don't know.
Earlier. I'm going to say 2003.
Okay.
I guess we'll never know. There's no way to find out.
We don't know.
Stay in your lane. Nicholas was very difficult to discipline. If he made up his mind he was going to do something, pretty much there wasn't a lot you could do. Nicholas had a history of running away. He had a criminal record for breaking and entering, stealing, truancy, and threatening his teachers. And he was also physically and verbally abusive to his mother.
I have a corrections corner. It came out in 2004.
Oh, I was so close.
You were so close. Okay, go ahead.
I got the vibe right. Yeah. So eventually, Beverly had to ask her son Jason to move in with them to help her with Nicholas. A family friend said that once Jason moved in, the home became truly volatile. Jason was addicted to drugs, and it drove Beverly to also become addicted. And neighbors reported that the police were called to the house multiple times after Jason moved in.
Hmm.
At age 13, Nicholas broke into a convenience store, stole a pair of shoes, and threatened a teacher. Now, I do not know if this was all one incident or if it was three separate incidents, because there are only like three sources about this story. One of them is a documentary, which does not mention it. And two are seem like they like ripped the information off of each other somehow. And they all just say these three things.
So wait, and he stole a pair of boots. He threatened a teacher. What was the other thing?
He broke into a convenience store, stole a pair of shoes, and threatened a teacher.
Okay, well, why would all three of those things... Okay, so the teacher was in the convenience store.
Yes, and the convenience store also sold shoes.
Are you sure he didn't steal the teacher's shoes?
No, I'm not sure. That's likely.
Can I get a suggestion from the audience about a place you could be? I heard convenience store. A profession. I heard teacher.
Teacher.
And something irreplaceable.
A pair of shoes.
I heard shoes.
Okay. So the hearing regarding this combined incident or one of the three or all three was scheduled for June 14th, 1994, and one of the possible outcomes was that Nicholas would be put in a group home for juvenile delinquents. On June 13th, 1994, Nicholas went to a Rite Aid, stole a pair of socks, and threatened a janitor.
Okay, this is just like...
I'm just kidding.
I was seriously going to be like, this is like the asylum version of the real story. Like, this is like the... What was their Transformers ripoff? Fuck. I worked on these movies.
Transmorphers.
Transmorphers. That's like the Transmorphers version of the real story. Went to a pharmacy, stole a pair of socks, and threatened a janitor. Incredible. No. No, he's something on fire, I would assume.
No. No. None of those things. On June 13th, 1994, Nicholas went out to play basketball with some friends. His mom gave him $5, told him to be home by dinner, and sent him on his way. His brother says that after a few hours, Nicholas called home to ask for a ride and said that he was a couple miles away from home. Jason claims that he didn't want to wake his mom up to tell her about the phone call because she works late and she was sleeping. So when she did wake up, Jason told his mom that Nicholas had called, he hadn't wanted to wake her up, and that he had told him to walk home. Nicholas never came home. So when he didn't return, Beverly reported him missing. She told the San Antonio Police Department that she thought he may have taken a ride from a stranger and that he wouldn't be afraid to do something like that. Authorities initially believed that Nicholas had run away because he had a history of running away.
And he had a hearing the next day.
Yes, and yeah, and he had been really vocal about how he didn't want to be put in a home. And so they were like, he probably ran away to escape that. And they did not take Beverly's report seriously. A few months after Nicholas disappeared, Jason called the San Antonio Police Department saying that Nicholas was trying to break into their garage. When the police arrived, there was no sign of forced entry or attempted forced entry, and Nicholas wasn't there, and they searched the neighborhood, and there was no trace of him, and the case went cold.
Hmm.
Then, in October 1997, 3 years and 4 months after Nicholas disappeared, the San Antonio Police Department got a phone call from a man who worked at a youth shelter in Linares, Spain. The caller said that there was a boy there named Nicholas Barclay who had escaped a sex slave ring operation. The San Antonio Police Department contacted the FBI and were connected with Special Agent Nancy B. Fisher. They asked her to locate Nicholas's family and let them know that they knew where he was. So Nancy called Carrie and she said, "When the FBI and the State Department assist you and get you and your brother home, I have to interview him immediately." So Carrie immediately called the shelter in Spain, where she was put on the phone with Jonathan Durant, who worked at the shelter. And he said he was talking to Nicholas. He was trying to confirm who he was. He said Nicholas was sitting next to him, but he was so scared and traumatized that he wouldn't talk to anyone. He said that Nicholas told him he had been abducted by a sex slave ring. He had escaped, and two tourists had found him in a phone booth. And he told Carrie that Nicholas didn't remember much of his life in San Antonio because of the trauma. And he said, "Well, I think he forgot about everything. He doesn't remember a lot. He remembers you, but not a lot more. So Carrie asked to speak to Nicholas, and she told him she loved him, but he didn't say anything back. And Jonathan Durant took the phone back and told her that Nicholas had said quietly, like, that he loved her, and Carrie assured Nicholas that she was going to come get him and bring him home. So Carrie got on the next flight to Spain. She said she didn't sleep for 2 nights before the flight. When she finally got to the shelter, she was escorted to a waiting room, and somebody from the shelter told her that Nicholas was in his room, that he had locked himself in there. He'd been there all day, and he wouldn't come out or let anyone in. So Carrie went into the courtyard, and she called to Nicholas, and she saw him peek out from behind a curtain in his room, and she was like, I'm here. I'm coming to take you home. So eventually Nicholas came downstairs, and in her own words, this is how Carrie felt to see Nicholas again. She said, it was just this immense sense of relief. I remember touching his nose and telling him, I remember that nose. You kind of look like your Uncle Pat. I started showing him pictures. He said, Jason looks the same. Cody's gotten pretty big, huh? God, Mom looks exactly the same. And he wanted to know if Grandpa was still an asshole. He told me how much he loved Grandma and missed her. I saw the tattoo of the cross on his hand, and I kept thinking how much he looked like Uncle Pat, and Mom would be surprised how tall he was. He talked in a funny accent, but it was always a whisper, like he was hiding from something. But I mean, God, look what he'd been through. He wasn't the same person. He wasn't the same Nicholas that disappeared 4 years before. He had been held and tortured and God knows what else. He wasn't that same person. He looked very different, like that he had grown up, and he was very quiet and kind of held back. So she confirmed to the shelter that...
Sorry.
I know. So she confirmed to the shelter that it was her brother, and they released him to her. And the night before the flight in the hotel, Carrie said that they didn't talk much, but that it wasn't an uncomfortable silence. It was like a peaceful silence. But the next day in the airport, Nicholas was visibly nervous, and he was like constantly moving, constantly going to the bathroom, watching people like a hawk. And Carrie said he was also constantly watching her. In Carrie's words, he's going back home and we don't know what's happened to him, how his mind is working. Maybe he was afraid that he wouldn't be recognized or Mom wouldn't love him anymore. When they said it was time for us to board, I nudged Nick and I said, you ready to go home? And he said, I'm ready to go home. And I said, let's get the fuck out of here and go home. And we got on the plane. So... Back in San Antonio, anticipation was high. Beverly, Carrie's husband, Nicholas's niece and nephew all drove to the airport to pick up Nicholas and Carrie. Beverly said, we had no idea what kind of person we were getting, who was coming back to us. But despite all the unknowns, everyone was very happy and excited to have Nicholas home. Beverly says of reuniting with Nicholas, I wanted to run and grab and hold him, but he held back. So I went and grabbed his hand and hugged him and told him I'd missed him. He had changed so much, it was like mind-boggling. But you tell yourself, well, he's been through all this stuff, so he's absolutely going to be different. He was totally covered up, so I got scared thinking, like, this kid is totally messed up. I watched him all the way home in the car, and you could tell he was uneasy. So we put on a tape and tried to make him as comfortable as possible. So... they got Nicholas home to San Antonio, and they tried to settle into, like, a normal routine to help him assimilate back into normal life. He went back to school. He started going to the park with his friends and playing basketball. He developed a crush on a girl in the neighborhood, and he would, like, talk to her on the phone and hang out with her, and the family would make fun of him for it, and he would blush. Carrie's husband, Nicholas's brother-in-law, would take Nicholas for drives, and he said they would just, like, talk and listen to music. But the family never talked about what happened to Nicholas in Spain, and they figured that they would leave it alone until he was ready to open up. So, while all of this was happening, the family never called Agent Fisher to let her know that they had gotten him home safely.
Mm-hmm.
So on November 4th, 1997, Agent Fisher took the initiative and asked to interview Nicholas at the San Antonio Missing Children's Center. The purpose of the interview was to get his accounts of his kidnapping and some information that would help them locate his abductors.
Yeah.
Here is what Agent Fisher's impression was. The only thing I knew about Nicholas was what I had read on some of the posters. Not that people can't change in 3 years, but this individual did not appear to be 16. He had a shadow of a beard, a dark beard, and I doubt that Nicholas would have had a shadow of a dark beard at 16 since he had blonde hair. Nicholas appeared to be very nervous and very uncomfortable the entire time, but he told her the following story. Back in 1994, while he was playing basketball with his friends, two young boys approached him. They started talking, and next thing he knew, there was a cloth over his mouth and Nicholas passed out. He was then taken by the military overseas. He was abducted, put in a van, and then onto a plane, and he never knew where he was, but the whole time he was kept in a room with other kids. He said that they would get chloroformed and then they would wake up and be in a place they were completely unfamiliar with. He said they were subjected to high-ranking military sexual abuse. He said every night all the kids were raped and molested by men, and that the men were American, Mexican, and European. He said they broke his hands, especially his right hand, with a baseball bat. He said they burned him repeatedly and fed him insects. He said that the boys were tortured, that they broke his fingers, they broke his left foot with a crowbar. He said that all of the boys were made to wear uniforms and they kept them in line by using military scare tactics and that the kids were experimented on. He said that they would put needles in his eyes and that they would put headphones over their ears of screaming and yelling in different languages and that they would play Spanish over and over saying, "You are not you." He said that if he spoke English, he was beaten. He said that they were moved around in military planes and they never knew where they were going. He said that their identities were changed by either changing their hair color, eye color, or other ways. He said that they put a solution in his eyes that changed his eye color from blue to brown. And then he said that one day a door wasn't shut and he ran out down a long hallway where there was another door and somehow he managed to get outside and he ran for hours until he discovered that he was in Spain. Agent Fisher told Nicholas's family what he told her and they were, of course, horrified. His brother-in-law said he was tortured. He had a broken hand that had never been medically attended to. He walked with a limp and he had cigarette burns down the back of his head to the back of his ankles. Meanwhile, in November 1997, Charlie Parker, a private investigator, got a call from a producer of the TV show Hard Copy asking him to track down this boy from San Antonio who had been missing for 3 years and had randomly turned up. So Charlie found out where Nicholas and his mother lived and he drove out. Now, Agent Fisher had told the family under no circumstances should they do any interviews or contact the media because if there was any truth to Nicholas's story, then the last place they wanted it was on TV or in the newspaper because then the abductor would know about their investigation.
Yeah.
Despite this request, Nicholas opted to do an interview on CBS and Charlie Parker got himself into the studio for that interview. During the interview, Charlie was put in a booth, and in that booth was a picture of Nicholas Barclay from before he disappeared. So Charlie looked at the photo, and he looked at Nicholas. And the first thing he noticed was that the Nicholas sitting in front of him had brown eyes, and the Nicholas in the picture had bright blue eyes. In Charlie's words, "Here was a moment where the hair stood on the back of your neck, and there was just something wrong about it. Something was wrong."
You know what I realized, is I think what like freaks me out so much about this is it's the high strangeness. Like it's the same, yes, it's like the same is, like uncanny yes. valley high strangeness effect that I think is what freaks me out so much about it. Like when we talk about like the Men in Black and stuff like that, like there's something about that. Where, and not to say that he's like not human, you know what I mean? But like, just it's the little details that it's just like the devil's in the details, you know what I mean? Just freaks me out so much. Gives me chills. And it gets so spooky.
It's gonna get worse. You ready? So then Charlie noticed something else. He had heard about Scotland Yard identifying Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassin by his ears, that they caught him at Heathrow Airport because they identified his ears. So Side note, I looked this up and I couldn't find any confirmation of this. I found one comment on one website where someone said, I heard that he was ID'd because of his ears. Has anyone else heard that? And nobody replied. So I don't know if that's true.
How do you identify the FBI's ears?
You see what I did there?
Yeah. I do. So I did look up ears as like a competitor for fingerprints, and here's what I learned. When you're born, your ears are fully formed, so it stays the same, so it is actually a very good way to identify people.
I know. I just like there. I think of people that I know. You also know these people, but like I think of people that I know that have like such distinctive ears.
I know, but you and I don't have particularly distinctive ears. But if I like saw a picture of your ears, I would probably be able to be like, "Those are Maggie's ears."
Yeah, that's for sure.
So, Charlie held up the picture of Nicholas and compared it to the Nicholas in front of him, and he was like, "Something's up." So he then put the picture of Nicholas and a picture of Nicholas from the interview into Photoshop, and they show this in the documentary, and I swear to you, early Photoshop looks like kid pics. I was like, is he in kid pics?
Ouch.
Oh, oh no.
That's what it is.
Oh no.
Oops. So he put the photos in kid pics and the ears didn't match. And he was like, that person in that interview is not Nicholas Barclay. Charlie says, I thought I had a spy. I thought I had a real, honest to God spy. Why else would a guy come here and take the place of another person? What would be his reason? So he called Agent Fisher, and from what I understand, she was just, like, not capable of processing this information objectively. And she says, why would you ever, ever take in a stranger? Not just a stranger from this country, but a stranger from another country who speaks in a French accent. This has to be Nicholas Barclay.
Yeah.
And Charlie.
Do you hear this?
What was that? Oh my God. More.
Oops. Uh-oh. Phew. Yikes.
Oh my God.
Oh no.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh my God. Sorry. I feel like I'm sitting in front of my desktop connected to AOL.
There is a video, I'll send it to you, of these guys that found a working computer inside an abandoned, like, asylum. And the computer was last used in, like, 2002, but they turn it on and get into it. And it's, like, it's such a trip to, like, watch an old Dell Please. Boot up with, like, Windows 98.
Oh, my God. Yeah. This is all I want. Yeah. Please send that to me.
I will. Okay, go on.
Oh, my God. So Charlie said of Agent Fisher's reaction, it was an outrageous thing. I couldn't talk to anyone that had read about this and said, wait a minute, I know my own kid. I know my own son. I can look in his eyes and tell. So at this point, in Agent Fisher's words, quote, I was pulling teeth trying to determine who had kidnapped Nicholas, when and where and under what circumstances. I had almost no information because all the information he gave us was very general. He couldn't give names, he couldn't give places, he couldn't give times, he couldn't give anything. So, Agent Fisher arranged for Nicholas to be interviewed by a forensic psychologist, Dr. Bruce D. Perry, at the Texas Children's Hospital in Houston. She told the family that the reason Nicholas was being taken to Houston was because he'd been through trauma, so he deserved to see a forensic expert to deal with that trauma. In Dr. Perry's words, originally, I thought this was going to be a forensic interview with the intent of finding out more information about the people who had abducted him. Here was this pale white kid, and I introduced myself, and as he spoke back, immediately something in me just said, this is not right. There's something wrong here. I didn't see the same physiological change in his body posture, in his pupil size, in his heart rate that I would normally see with someone who's talking about a traumatic experience. Dr. Perry also says that Nicholas could not speak English without an accent. He said, that told me about the development of his brain and the development of language. You just cannot be raised for the first 6 to 7 years of your life in an English-speaking home and then later on, 8 to 9 years later or even 10 years later, not be able to speak English without an accent. He said, I can guarantee you that this kid was not raised in an English-speaking family. I don't know who he is, but the person I interviewed could not have been Nicholas Barclay.
It's so interesting because it's like, I don't know, like when you just like put all the facts together, like convenience store teacher shoe stealing, when you just say like his eye color was wrong, he didn't speak English, and like he was not reliving his trauma, like I'm like, okay, like it just sounds like sparsical almost, like it's like silly, like it's so outrageous. But I think about like the changeling, which is like a similar situation where like that woman was like, this is not my child. And everyone was like, oh, she's gone mad. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. It's just like, there's something so insidious about it, but also something like when you zoom out macro, that's just like so outrageous about it. It's like hard to believe almost.
Yeah, no, it is. It's absolutely outrageous and hard to believe. So Agent Fisher was like, this is literally the worst case scenario. She immediately called Carrie and was like, listen, Dr. Perry said that this person isn't your brother and he could be dangerous. And apparently Carrie was like, oh my God. And Agent Fisher was like, do not go to the airport. We will handle this. You do not have to take this stranger home with you. Don't come pick him up. And Carrie was like, okay, I won't. So in Agent Fisher's words, we fly back to San Antonio and Carrie was standing there. She acted like we'd never had that conversation. She acted excited to see him. She asked him how his trip was. I think I just stared for a minute. And then I called the U.S. Attorney's office and I said, what do I do? And the assistant U.S. attorney said, let him return to her temporarily.
The U.S. attorney's assistant was like, that's not Carrie. Carrie has blue eyes. They're all just like, it's like impostering each other now.
There's just like 10 of them interchanging.
It's like Inception, like with imposters, like imposterception. And he has to pretend that he thinks that she's the same because otherwise
he has to pretend to be like, oh, my sister can't be.
And she's like, oh, my brother. I always spoke English until now, French but now I don't. Yeah. But they can't, like, she'll call his bluff if he outs her. And the mom is just like, what's happening?
That's amazing. So Agent Fisher said, she welcomed this person home just like he was her brother. I didn't have any clue as to why she behaved in this manner, because in my conversation with her, I said, this person is not your brother.
Oh, this person?
Oh, this one? I thought you meant...
Shit. Her other brother is, like, locked in the garage.
They're like, Jason, who are you?
You just cut to, like, hello? Oh, this one?
Oh, this one? Oh, fuck.
Damn, I liked like this one.
He's like, je suis désolé. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Nice.
I'm sorry.
Nice. So, at this point, both Charlie Parker and Agent Fisher knew that Nicholas was not Nicholas. Charlie said, maybe they wanted him so badly to be their son that they said he was their son, but it was starting to get ridiculous. I couldn't let it go. There was no way in the world I could let it go. Agent Fisher was like, we got to get some DNA samples so we can prove that this is not Nicholas.
Smart.
So she contacted the family to try to get DNA samples. At the same time, Charlie Parker was going around the neighborhood interviewing neighbors about the family, and he found out about the numerous police visits for domestic disturbances. And he also did some digging and found out about the phone call that Jason made about Nicholas trying to break into the garage. He said, we see stuff like that all the time. People are constantly doing stuff like that to make people think that that person is still alive.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
I started to put two and two together, and I thought, something happened to that boy inside that house.
Yeah.
So, Charlie Parker started tailing them. He would sit outside their house and write down the license plate of every car that visited Beverly's home. When Agent Fisher asked for DNA samples, Beverly was like, I know this is my son. I don't have to provide blood samples for DNA. And when Fisher showed up to collect the samples, Beverly laid on the floor and was screaming, you can't make me. Agent Fisher said that Beverly wasn't just apathetic, she was actively hostile. She said, I no longer saw them as a grieving, victimized family. I saw them as a very questionable family. There would be no reason for them to accept a stranger into their lives unless there was something to hide.
Oof, yeah. Good point.
So Agent, right?
I think so this Agent, is like around the place where I turned the documentary off when I watched it.
Oh, this is where it gets good. Great. This is where it gets a little bit less creepy.
More mystery for me.
When it rains, it pours. Yeah. So Agent Fisher realized that if the family wasn't going to cooperate, she would have to obtain a warrant for blood samples.
Oh my God. But if you, maybe I might be jumping the gun on this. If you did something bad like that, and then as a result, can you imagine if they were like, this is your kid, and you have to be like, oh my God, it is! That is him! What a
no
surprise!
Way.
Nicholas! And he's like, hello, mother. And she's like, yes, that is so... We are so happy to have you back.
That is what fucks me up so much about this story, is like, what are the fucking chances? Like, and this is what I was thinking while I was researching. I was like, the... chances are so slim, and we'll get, like, the more you learn about this, the more you'll be like, the chances are so, like, what are the chances? Like, how did this happen? But it is bananas.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Agent Fisher got a warrant for blood samples. She took three agents with her to go pick them up. She got fingerprints and palm prints, and she sent them around the country to Interpol and to embassies. Meanwhile, Nicholas was becoming more agitated and very angry, and Agent Fisher was afraid that he was going to run away. Finally, Nicholas Barclay agreed to meet with Charlie Parker at the same time that Agent Fisher got a response from the I don't know what this word is. Legat? L-E-G-A-T-E?
No idea.
No idea. It's an official... in Madrid, Spain.
Legat?
So Legat. No, I think it's an English word.
Legat.
Listen.
Legat.
The Legat. Legate. I don't think. I mean, I just don't know. We'll never know. When was 13 Going on 30 released?
There's no way to know.
There's literally no way to know.
Is it a member of the clergy? Oh, no. It's definitely not a governor of ancient Rome.
No, I think it is.
Oh, okay, great. Let's see. Legate.
Legate?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So she got a call from the legate in Madrid, Spain.
Okay.
So Nicholas sat down with Charlie Parker. Charlie said to him, you made your mother really angry. And he said, she's not my mother and you know it. And Charlie thought, and I quote, we'll all be damned. You're going to finally tell me who you are. Who are you? And Nicholas said, I'm Frederick Bourdon, and I'm wanted by Interpol.
Well, shit, once again, you didn't have to tell us that, but I'm so glad you did.
No, you'll find out why he told him.
Okay.
All right, do you want to take a break before I tell you the second half of this mystery?
Yeah.
Okay,
let's
great.
Let's do it. Okay. I'm so excited. Okay. We'll be back after these kid pick sounds.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Uno, 0.
Kid picks, come on and play with kid picks.
Wow.
Change it up, draw it up, move it up. There it is, move around, add the sound.
Now that funky
we're back.
And we're back to Soothing Existential Radio. We're your hosts. The thoughts that keep you up at night about whether or not you are a success or a failure and how you define success.
Today on our show, what do your parents really think of you?
Yours are always so good. You have a lot of it's practice with these.
This is what I think about constantly.
Classic.
Okay, are you ready?
Today on our show, is your child really your child? More at 11. Something in your fridge could be killing you.
Okay, ready?
Yeah.
So, when we left off, Nicholas told Charlie Parker, I'm Frederick Bourdain, and I'm wanted by Interpol. Now. So, am I saying that right, Bourdain?
Bourdain.
Bourdain.
How's it spelled?
B-O-U-R-D-I-N.
Bourdain.
Okay, I'm going to say it like the Texans do, which is Bourdain.
Okay.
So, Frederick Bourdain was 23 years old. He was from France, and he was a lifelong identity thief.
Wait, how old was he? 14?
Nicholas was 13 when he disappeared. So he would be 17.
And how old was 18. Nicholas Bourdain?
Frederick.
I mean, whatever. Yeah, Frederick Bourdain.
he was 23.
Jesus Christ. Okay.
Yeah. So his grandfather was racist. And when he found out that his daughter, I know, when he found out that his daughter, Frederick's mother, was pregnant at 17 by an Algerian man, he was very vocal about his distaste for the situation, and he urged her to abort the child. She kept him, but Frederick says, before I was born, I already had the wrong identity. When I was born, I didn't think there was much love, so for as long as I can remember, I wanted to be someone else, someone who was acceptable.
This is a really solid core wound, I feel.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's written. Very good writing.
Well written, yeah.
Yeah.
See, but this is the thing again, is like, this is either a, like, broad comedy or it's a tragedy, just depending on, like, how you read the stakes. Because the idea of, like, a 23-year-old trying to pass him off as a 17-year-old or 16-year-old or whatever, that just, like so obviously is not that person, is either... like Mrs. Doubtfire, or it's the changeling. So it just like depends on, you know what I mean? Like it depends on how you frame it, really.
Yeah, it's either like Moliere or like a Shakespearean tragedy.
I was just thinking like it's either farce, like Tartuffe.
Yeah, it can be Tartuffe for sure.
Yeah. Or it's like Richard the Third.
I made it Richard the Third. I'm giving it Richard III vibes. So, Frederick was born in... excuse me. I'm a lady.
On our lady show.
This is our lady show for ladies. So... So, Frederick was born in Nanterre, a suburb of Paris, and he was raised by his grandparents in Nantes, France. I'm pretty sure it was his mom's parents.
Okay.
But again, this information is from those two articles that copied each other. So, I'm not 100% sure. As a child, he ran away.
Wait, it did not even occur to me how funny this is, but are you telling me that one article was essentially an imposter? Are you telling me that one article was pretending to be the other article? I cannot believe that was lost on us for this far, like this much of the episode.
It's because I was making it Richard the Third.
That is so funny.
Okay, so as a child, Frederick ran away and eventually ended up in Paris, where he started impersonating other people, and he assumed at least 500 false identities.
Oh my God, I can't even remember two different passwords.
All my passwords are the same.
Like, how do you? Oh my God.
Okay. Here is Frederick's side of the story. So, he was found by some tourists in a phone booth in Spain. He was wearing a big coat and clothes that he intentionally picked to make him look young. He wore a hat very low so nobody could see his eyes. His goal, he said, is to make police believe from minute one that they are dealing with a lost kid. He said he wanted to make them feel a sense of guilt. He said, when you see a kid with nervous reflexes that you can't touch him, you can't approach him, then you understand that something is wrong.
When you see a kid who's dressed like Paddington.
He was dressed like Paddington.
You know something is wrong.
Time, I encourage everybody to watch this documentary with that image in their head, because I swear to you, in the documentary, they do reenactments with this guy who looks so much like Frederick that, like, it's uncanny.
That's also ironic.
Another imposter.
Yeah.
And the way they dress him, and even in pictures of Nicholas and, like, home videos of Frederick as Nicholas, he looks like fucking Paddington Bear.
Well, I encourage everyone to go watch Paddington 2, because it's, like, the greatest film of all time.
I have still not seen it.
You would love it.
I know. That's why I haven't seen it.
Okay.
Okay. So, he said he didn't speak much because he knew that if the police couldn't get information from a kid about who they are or where they're from, they eventually have to put them in a children's home, and that is exactly what he wanted. And it is exactly what he got. In his own words.
The real Nicholas would have hated to go to a children's home.
Well.
He hated it so much.
The vibe is different. So Frederick says, nobody ever gave a damn about me. And to know that if I changed my identity, the reward was eventually to be put in a place where people cared about me. Hell yeah. I was reborn. I was born again. Nobody ever gave me a childhood, because to give a kid a childhood, you need to love that kid. Aww. I felt like I belonged there. They didn't know I was 23 years old. I was considered one of them. Which is like...
That is sad.
It breaks my heart. Unfortunately, the home that he was in was a place that, quote, can't stand having a kid with no identity card, no proof of who he is. And they told Frederick that if he didn't tell them who he was, they would fingerprint him. So he had a choice. Get fingerprinted and go to prison, or prove to them that he was actually somebody. He said he was an American. He said that he ran away and that he was willing to contact his family, but he wanted to do it himself because he didn't want his family to just get a call from random authorities. He told them that in order to do this, he would need an office for the night because of the time difference. He said, I knew I could pass myself off as anyone on the phone. I could convince anyone of anything. So he called the police in America. He just called tons of stations all over the country. And every time he said that he was a policeman in Spain named Jonathan Dorian and that they had found a kid. He said that they were sure he was from the States, but they weren't sure where, and that he'd been missing maybe for a few years, and that somebody must be looking for him. And the police were like, listen, buddy, we have hundreds of posters of missing children. We're not going to, like, go through them one by one with you, but we will connect you with the Center for Missing and Exploited Children in Arlington, Virginia. So he called the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and he told them, we have a kid in a shelter. He's American. He's 14 to 15 years old. We don't know who he is. And then he described himself, and he gave them details that he knew that he could handle, but were vague enough that they could match a large number of missing children. So the people at the center were like, there's this kid from San Antonio who's been missing since 1994. His name is Nicholas Barclay. And he asked them for a fax of a photo of Nicholas, and he receives like this black and white fax of the poster for Nicholas. In Frederick's words, he was missing for 3 or 4 years. That guarantees that there would have been a change. If there's a change, there's doubt. If there's doubt, I could do it.
Ugh, that is like so freaky. But also, I just want to say, okay, so it was clearly, once again, the fault of the American, like,
fucking
cops.
Incompetent police work.
Because they, well, I was going to say, like, not only is this whole thing their fault, but also it's their fault, like, that he got fucked up because they sent him a fax of, like, a black and white photo.
I know.
Like, his scheme actually was, like, you know, I mean, I guess, did they have color faxes at that time? Probably
well,
not.
Just wait. Just wait. So, Frederick told them that they had Nicholas. Now, Frederick knew that after he told them that they had Nicholas, that the family would then try to contact him. So, Carrie called. He spoke to her as Jonathan Dorian. He put Nicholas on the phone.
Yeah.
And he said as few words as he could.
Smart.
In Frederick's words, I washed her brain.
Mm.
After the phone call, Frederick says, I didn't stop because I didn't think of stopping. I didn't watch myself in the mirror and say, what the fuck are you doing? Stop that immediately. I realized that I crossed the line. I wasn't pretending anymore to have another identity. I stole one. So the embassy and the FBI immediately started working on verifying Nicholas's identity and bringing him home. The next day, they sent a color copy of Nicholas's missing poster.
Oh, no.
And Frederick says that this is when it got beyond his control. Nicholas had blonde hair and blue eyes, and Frederick looked nothing like Nicholas.
Oh my God. He would have gotten away with it too.
If it weren't for those meddling color copies.
Like colorblind cops.
So, the people at the home told Frederick that the embassy was coming. The vice consul of the embassy to Spain reported that Nicholas spoke English and that he was, at least for the moment, convinced that this boy was Nicholas. The
Did
next
he
morning,
look at the color copy?
I don't think so. It also sounded like the only reason he believed that was because he spoke English.
Yeah.
So, who knows? The next morning, the director of the shelter told Frederick, you must be so happy. Your sister's on the way. She's on a plane. She's coming to get you. In Frederick's words, I should have thought of that. I should have thought of the consequences. Imagine you're the father of a kid that's been missing for 3 years and 4 months and they find him in Colombia. What would you do? What would be the first thing you do? I would jump on a fucking plane.
Yeah, correct.
You can't prepare to play a role, a person that you don't know. I couldn't be Nicholas Barclay because I didn't know Nicholas Barclay. I didn't even know at that moment if he was left or right-handed. So that was a problem.
Oh my God.
So Frederick did everything he could to give himself even the slightest chance of pulling this off. He bleached his hair. He had a girl at the shelter give him stick and poke tattoos to match Nicholas's tattoos. And he got big sunglasses and a hat and a scarf, thinking if she sees Paddington, she won't know I'm not her brother.
Literally, exactly.
So when Carrie arrived, he waited
in his
room.
Don't make me sing.
Don't make me sing. When Carrie arrived, he waited in his room and he like she called out to him from the courtyard and he like looked out and he was like, ah, shit. And then at some point he was like, well, I guess the only thing I can do is go downstairs and see what happens. So
and
he goes
just yes-handed his way to Texas.
He yes-handed his way to San Antonio. So he goes downstairs and he sees Carrie. And this is what he says about this. She didn't even wait a second or 2 seconds. She jumped on me. She took me in her arms and said, "Nicholas, oh, you were afraid I wouldn't recognize you. I remember that. Knows everything is going to be fine. I know it's you." Only God knows why she would do something like that, but I know one thing for sure. There was no other way. She came for me and she wanted me back. We went to the waiting room and she showed me dozens of pictures. You remember, this was with Mom, the house we were living in when you went missing. Remember, this was when you were playing with Scotty. Remember, remember, remember. So, he had Carrie convinced. He had the embassy official convinced, but he had to convince the police and the judge that he was Nicholas Barclay. So, the police and the judge did a test. They showed him pictures that Nicholas would never have seen before, and he got 4 out of 5 right, and they were convinced. Frederick says that he would not have been able to do this if Carrie hadn't sat him down first and showed him so many pictures and told him so many specific details. So, they declared him a U.S. citizen, they gave him a passport, and he left the shelter with Carrie. That night in the hotel, Frederick says, "I'd been thinking about running away even before I met her. All I had to do was take a taxi, go to a train station, and buy myself a ticket out of Spain. I could have done that in a couple of minutes. Nothing was stopping me. I went down the hallway a few times. I was always wondering if I was doing the right thing. Should I go? Should I not go? But a new identity with a real passport, a U.S. passport, I could go to the U.S., go to school there, and just be someone and don't have to ever worry again about being identified. I saw the opportunity. A woman that would go through so much to get me back with her, in a family that has kids, which is a loving family, that's got to be somebody good. The only problem was, Carrie wanted me to be Nicholas, but what about the others?" So they got on the plane. And Frederick was like, "Here we go."
Yeah, I guess.
He said, "I never liked people to touch me, and I can't change that. So when Beverly put her hands around me, she must have felt that. I was very cold, very closed. I didn't speak to people. As happy as I was, I didn't show it. I had a border in front of me. I didn't want to screw up. But I had a family, and even more. I had never dreamed of so much. I had never dreamed to be able to not only stay in a place where I'm loved, but to actually have a family."
My heart.
Which just breaks my heart. So he went home. And he says, "The first thing when you open your eyes is officially that your name is Nicholas Patrick Barclay, that you're born on December 31st, 1980, and that every family member is calling me Nicholas. Not what is your real name? Nicholas. They drove me around and I knew that I had to recognize something, but I also knew that I couldn't because I'd never been there before. We met some people that knew Nicholas before he disappeared. I told them that I didn't remember them, that there was something, but I didn't remember them, like I had lost my memory." He said that he had seen pictures of Nicholas making a peace sign, so he just, like, did it with people, and they were like, "Oh, that's Nicholas."
Also, it was, like, an unfortunate setup to come to America and have to, like, try to recognize things, because if you go to, like, Spain or, like, London, like, you can just pick anything old and be like, "Oh, that church has always been there," because it has. But in the U.S., because this country is, like, not that old, like, you could point to a building and be like, "I remember," and they could be like, "That was built in 1999. Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. There's, like, it's just, like, it's harder here, I feel.
It's so much harder.
Especially in, like, yeah, anyway. Yeah.
So he also said that he was terrified that Nicholas Barclay would show up any day.
That would be my fear too.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Knowing what he didn't know, you know, like not knowing what he didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. So he says, "It really became the American dream for me when I took that big yellow bus to school with other students." Aww. "How many French adults go to American schools for kids on a yellow bus?" God. "I finally succeeded in becoming a kid again. To have a second chance to be able to go to school and to succeed this time." Aww. And I'm just like, you Sweet, sweet sociopath.
He could have had a podcast, you know, and been really successful. He didn't have to do this.
He didn't have to. So the only person in the family that he hadn't met was Jason, Nicholas's brother. And when he finally met him, he says, he didn't look at me like I was Nicholas, and he didn't pretend to look at me like I was Nicholas. And he said good luck to me, and he left.
Hmm.
So, as we know, he did the CBS interview, which led Charlie to conclude he wasn't Nicholas, and the FBI came for blood samples, and Beverly threw a fit.
Mm-hmm.
Frederick says,
Qui when bono.
Beverly refused... Qui bono! Frederick says, when Beverly refused to give her blood sample, I started to become suspicious. They knew I wasn't Nicholas. Whatever I was telling them, they didn't believe a word of it, but they were good at not showing it. Who wouldn't see it? I remember in Spain, Carrie did everything for me. When I didn't know something, she told me, you forgot everything, but you're going to remember it now. This was Mom at the place we were living. This was Chantel. Do you remember Chantel? That's your niece, my daughter. Do you remember that? Over and over and over again. She wanted to put it in my head so I would never forget. She just could not say it wasn't Nicholas. Did she believe it or not? If you ask me, I would say no. Not for a second did she believe I was her brother. She decided I was going to be her brother. It's like I woke up in a place where the lie is even bigger than what I did.
Yeah, also, like, once again, because, like I said earlier, can you imagine being in the family's position? Can you imagine being in this guy's position where you, like, think you're pulling a con, and then they're like, yes, you are our brother.
So
and you're like, oh, shit,
crazy.
You guys are worse than me. Like,
so
this shit's scary.
Crazy.
Yeah.
So he said, I didn't need to be Columbo to put all the pieces together. They killed him. Some of them did it, some of them knew it, and some of them chose to ignore it. I wasn't worried about Nicholas coming back anymore.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
So freaky.
So this knowledge, like, wore on him. And that's when he started to become more agitated and angrier. And he felt more and more that he couldn't pretend to be Nicholas anymore. So he started looking for a way out. And that's when he agreed to meet with Charlie Parker.
Yeah.
So Frederick was arrested on March 4th, 1998. He contacted the San Antonio Police Department and told them, like, they killed him. So
yeah.
The police department opened a homicide investigation. Agent Fisher says, if Beverly knew that this individual was not her son, then she had to have some type of ulterior motive, and it had to be something very scary for her to accept a stranger into her house posing as her own son. So.
Very good, Clarice.
Dr. Lecter. So they gave her a polygraph, and she passed. And Agent Fisher was like, that's not possible. Do it again. So they gave her another polygraph, and she passed again. And Agent Fisher asked for a third one. And on the third polygraph test, Beverly failed every single question. Agent Fisher says, the polygrapher said the machine practically jumped off the table. Her answers appeared to be false on everything. He turned to her and he said, Mrs. Dollarhide, it appears that you know where your son is. It appears that you know what happened to him. And she became very agitated and she jumped up and she ran out screaming. Now, Beverly says,
I wonder if she, like, took some measures on the first two tests.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean? Like, I wonder if she, like, took, I don't know, like, a downer or, like, did the thing you can do where you, like, fool, like, during the questions that establish your, like, resting heart rate and stuff, you know, you, like, get your heart rate up so that it seems like your resting heart rate is really high.
Oh,
so that
yeah.
I wonder if she just, like, did some stuff to, like, fool the polygraph and then could, like, on the last one she couldn't.
It's possible. I think it really depends on how you view Beverly, because there's, like, two Beverlys you can see, and one of them would definitely be capable.
Well, that's
of
ironic.
That.
I'm sensing a theme here.
So Beverly says of the polygraph tests, I agreed to take a lie detector test. I lied about stealing, and that's why I failed. I didn't lie about anything to do with Nicholas. It was the other questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Agent Fisher also suspected that Jason knew something about Nicholas's disappearance. And when she finally got in contact with him, she says, I asked him about the disappearance of his brother. He just seemed totally apathetic about it and didn't care that he had been returned. When he did see him, he knew, no, it wasn't his brother, but he didn't seem interested enough to tell his mother and sister. They just wanted to believe. He was very hostile and he refused to help in any way. Soon after that interview, Jason left the rehab center he was in and he was found dead of an overdose.
Oh.
Yeah. Carrie, Nicholas's sister, says, Jason became a perfect scapegoat because he's not here. He died, so he can't be questioned. He can't even defend himself. I know my brother or my mother did not kill Nicholas. Accidentally, on purpose, whatever Frederick said, it never happened. Show me one piece of evidence. Show me anything that would lock anybody in our family up over this. Just one shred of actual proof. The biggest, funniest thing to me is that we went and picked up a complete stranger to hide the fact that we killed Nicholas or someone in my family killed Nicholas. When, through 4 years that he was gone, we were the only ones looking for him. Why would we go pick up a stranger to hide something that didn't need to be hidden? It's just another one of his lies. He's a habitual liar, and it blows my mind that anybody could take anything that is said out of his mouth as truth. He put us through enough already, and for him to do this while he's in jail for what he's done to cause more pain for our family, fuck him. And Carrie has a point, because when Frederick was in jail for impersonating Nicholas, he made hundreds of calls claiming to have false information about lost children. And when he was asked about his behavior, he readily admitted that he didn't have any information and that he didn't know why he did it. And the way that Carrie says this, like, it's such a powerful moment because it's really hard to watch her say those words and not believe her. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see her, you can see that she's not lying. And she really mm-hmm. feels that. Or she's a phenomenal actress, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So the homicide investigation was eventually closed due to lack of evidence. Frederick was convicted of perjury and fraudulently obtaining a passport, and he was sentenced to 6 years in prison. He was deported to France in October 2003, and 3 months later, he attempted to steal the identity of a missing 14-year-old boy named Leo Bally. Frederick now lives in France with his wife and 3 children. And Nicholas Barclay has still not been found. The end.
I hate that.
Right? Isn't that?
I hate that. The thing that, like, the other thing that just drives me fucking up a wall is it's like there are actual missing and exploited children and, like, so many resources that were just, like, wasted in the process of this, like, gigantic snowball lie. Just, like, drives me crazy.
Yeah, it's like in that VeggieTales episode where Junior Asparagus tells a white lie and then it starts out as like a little amoeba and then it grows and grows until it's a big purple monster.
If someone ever tried to imposter you, I would know so quickly that it wasn't you. Like, there's just no way.
You'd be like, how much VeggieTales have you seen? Can you sing Madame Blueberry's song, I'm So Blue? I'm so blue.
Oh my god. I would know.
I would know if someone was trying to impersonate you. No one has those eyebrows.
That's true. These are a stabile family legacy.
It's a stabile family exclusive.
You could not possibly impersonate my eyebrows.
No. I love them. I think they're
the
great.
Way that they grow, the way that one part of them grows in the opposite direction of the rest of it is, like, I think unique to me. It's Send us an email if your eyebrows grow in the wrong, like, in two different directions.
My eyebrows grow in two different directions.
Does the part closest to, like, the inside just grow straight up?
Yeah.
And the rest of it grow, like, toward the side of your head?
Yeah, like, they just had different ideas of what they wanted to be. The hairs.
Yeah. The hair. Yeah.
So.
Wow, that was a great mystery. Well done. Well researched.
Thank you.
That was phenomenal. I hated it. Thanks. I hate it.
My only goal is for you to think that my mysteries are great and that you hate them. All right. Well.
Hey, follow us on all the things. We're on TikTok now. Mystery Team Inc.
Yeah. Email us, DM us, reach out. We love hearing from you.
If you have any information, I'm sure there's a phone number you can call.
Yeah, just Google San Antonio Police Department. Worst guy there.
We should make business cards, maybe.
For the San Antonio Police Department, worst guy there.
Yeah. Yeah. Buckle the buck up.
Stay in your lane.
We don't know.
Smooches.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Hey guys, just popping in for a quick post-show note. If you or someone you know is a victim of or has info on child trafficking, you can contact the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children at 1-800-THE-LOST, 1-800-843-5678, or you can report online at cybertipline.org.